Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Now You Know, talk radio where you get to ask the questions. Call us now at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. And now, here are your hosts, Ann Mitchell and Brian McCullough.
Ann Mitchell, how are you doing this fine evening?
Why, Brian McCullough, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you know, it was quite tough to secure you, but I'm glad that we did because you're going to have a great show tonight. I have no doubt.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. In fact, I have to tell you that we're already getting calls. We've already been getting voicemail, and there are people Twittering, and you can listen to us in iTunes now. We just have so many ways to connect that you can connect with us. I'm just really excited. Brian, do you want to tell them all the different ways they can connect while I look up our iTunes URL to tell them what it is?
Well, you're not going to be able to tell them what that iTunes URL is because it's long and ugly, but they can search for us in iTunes. Now you know. You can search for Ann Mitchell. Filter it by podcast, and it'll show up that way. We'll also have a link, of course, to the iTunes page on our website. If you want to call in and talk to Ann, now tonight we're going to be talking about, Ann is going to be talking to us about one of her specialities, which is father's rights. You are a father's rights attorney or have been in a prior life, is that correct?
That is correct. I was one of the only father's rights lawyers in the country, and I still advocate for father's rights, although I did close my private practice, but I maintain a website, I have a book, and I still care very much about father's rights.
And it's a very fascinating and somewhat misunderstood topic, so I'm really anxious to get into it. But if you want to call in and talk to Ann tonight, you can call 877-NYK-RADIO, that's 877-NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO, 877-695-7234. You can Twitter us a question at Now You Know Radio. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're the Twitter expert there. And then, of course, you can join the chat room if you go to blogtalkradio.com/nowyouknowradio. You can join our chat room, ask questions there. We've got callers calling in already, so we're going to jump into that real quick. But, Ann, give us however long you want, history of how you got into being a father's rights attorney and maybe what you saw while you were in there.
Well, what I saw while I was in there, that certainly would be several shows in and of themselves. Before we start, I just want to say a couple of things. One is, as Brian knows, I'm trying a new sound system right now. So this is sort of an experiment. And so if Brian, you know, feels he needs to tell me, speak closer, speak louder, just please let me know. And you guys out there, please let me know also if you're feeling like I'm not sounding as clear or whatever, let me know so I can adjust it on my end. The second thing is people have been asking me, those of them who know that I'm in Boulder, Colorado, they've been asking me about the fire. It is raging in Boulder. It is to the west of us, but only a few miles. We can see it from our front door. There's just huge flames and a glow coming from across, we can see across the way to the first set of ridges there, and it is quite frightening. We have very many friends who are evacuated, but we are all right, and we don't seem to be in any danger. But I want to thank you for your questions and your wishes, and just wanted to throw that out there as well. So as to how I got involved in it, it's kind of an interesting story, I think, primarily because most people used to say to me when they would meet me, they would say, "But Ann, you're a divorced single custodial mother. Now, how is it possible that you could have gotten into father's rights?" And in fact, I have had women call me a traitor to my sex, which I consider to be quite a compliment, given the sources. But the way that it happened was I was putting myself through undergraduate school, and I was doing this by running a dental office. I was the office manager. And this was an office in downtown Buffalo, and so it was right near the court, and we had a lot of attorneys as patients. And one of our patients came breezing in really late for her appointment, and she was very apologetic. She said, "I'm so sorry I'm late for this appointment, but I was at the Capitol testifying. I'm part of the New York Family Law Bar, and I was testifying about the new proposed child support legislation." And I said, "Well, you're in favor of child support legislation, right?" And she said, "Oh, no, this is a terrible law." And she started telling me all the reasons it was such a horrible law. And it had to do primarily with, first of all, that it gave judges no discretion at all to make allowances in a case. So it set up a formula that, which is really pretty much the law of the land. Now, most states have a formula where you look at your income, you look at how many kids there are, and you look at how much time the children are with each parent. And that's pretty much it. That dictates how much child support the non-custodial parent will be paying. But because this particular law made it so that the judge could not deviate at all unless they jumped through so many hoops that no judge would ever have done this, it meant that people who were already paying to the best of their ability were really going to be in a lot of trouble, especially because the other aspect of it was that it was retroactive, which meant that someone could have been paying to the best of their ability, paying faithfully every month, and all of a sudden find out that they were now in arrears thousands of dollars. And she was explaining this to me, and as she was explaining it to me, I was thinking about my very recent own personal experience with the family law system. I was very recently divorced, a single mother, and our divorce had been, I thought, very contentious. Now I know that it was really quite tame compared to some. But the point is, our divorce had just been finalized. And even though we were through, for a split second, I did the calculations and realized that with this new law, I could have destroyed him. And for that split second, it was really tempting.
Wow.
And I quickly shook that off and I went, "Oh my God. Here I am. I'm already done with my divorce." And the power this would have given me, that I just for that split second, the power trip that was there of how I could have destroyed him. He had just lost his job. He had a baby on the way with his new fiance. And I could have absolutely destroyed him. And after that split second when it was tempting, I was horrified. And somehow, and I don't know how, but somehow I had the presence of mind to realize that if this passed, what it would do is it would cause these guys who really were on the edge trying to make it, it would cause them to go underground because they wouldn't be able to do it.
Right.
And that would be really bad for kids. You know, the kids, first of all, the moms and the kids wouldn't be getting any support, but more importantly, the kids wouldn't have their dads. So that's really what galvanized me. And I said to her, I was extremely politically naive at that point in time, and I said to her, "Yeah. Oh my gosh, well, someone has to do something. We have to have a referendum." Well, New York doesn't have a referendum, but again, I was politically naive. I had no idea. I thought that citizens could, you know, just go to the Capitol and get something going like that. So I ended up founding an organization. It had the unfortunate name of, it was called People for Reasonable and Intelligent Support Measures, which, of course, the acronym is PRISM, as in you can look through a prism, it bends light.
Right.
But when I would call, I would say, "Hello, this is Ann Mitchell calling from PRISM." And you could see where that's going. People thought it meant people, you know, I was calling from prison. So anyway, that was a very poor name. That was a good lesson in naming organizations. But
right,
it was specifically founded to go and testify in Albany about this law and how bad it was. And I'm very happy to say that even though that was my very first foray into politics and fathers' rights, that we were at least in part responsible for the fact that those two really bad aspects of the law were taken out and were not passed. So that's how I got started in fathers' rights. And then very briefly, I know we have callers, but very briefly, I finished undergrad and I went off to law school. I moved to California to go to law school in Stanford. And frankly, by that time, I thought, you know what, it had already been a couple of years. I was working in father's rights, and I thought, I've done my civic duty. I'm done now. My daughter and I, you know, again, remember, I was a single parent. You know, her father and she have a good relationship, and I always encouraged it. But she came with me to California by agreement with her father, and I thought, you know, now I'm going to graduate from law school, and I'm going to get a big job at a big firm and make lots of money, and, you know, I'm not going to be a poor single parent anymore, and we're going to live high, you know. That was sort of what I was thinking going into law school, but as soon as I graduated, well, even before I graduated, it was really clear I was going to not be able to walk away from it, because once you have something like this under your skin and you really feel it, you just can't turn your back on it. And in fact, when I, you know, I founded a father's rights organization during law school. I ran a father's rights bulletin board from a computer in my student housing. And when I graduated, I was looking at the possibility of an offer from one of those big Silicon Valley firms, and an offer from a tiny two-lawyer firm that did family law and personal injury, and they were going to pay me half of what the big firm was going to pay me, but they were going to give me all the family law I could have. They were going to let me still do my father's rights work. And when they took me even before I passed the bar, and they said, once you pass the bar, we're giving you our family law department. And I just, wow. I couldn't walk away from that.
Well, that's great.
So that's the brief story.
It shows you have an incredible passion and desire for this. Well, let me just say that the switchboards have lit up, so we need to get to some callers here. If you're on the line and you want to talk to Ann, be sure to hit 1, because that indicates to us that you have a question. But first, let's throw it to Rob, who's an old favorite. And Rob, what do you have for Ann today, Rob?
Hi, Ann. I've got 2 questions for you.
Hi there, Rob. Thank you for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, great, great. So the 2 questions are, what is the legal definition of father? And the second question is, are there any universally accepted father's rights?
I'm sorry. Brian, could you repeat the second question for me? Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
I couldn't hear your second question. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yes, the second question is, are there any universally accepted father's rights?
Okay, thank you. So the first question is, what is the legal definition of father? And the second definition is, are there any universally accepted father's rights? And those are great questions, and they're actually connected, and so I will answer them essentially together. First of all, when you talk about father in terms of family law, what you're really talking about is paternity. So you're talking about, is this person the biological father? And so in that context, what the law means by father is the person who is the male parent, typically. Where that would be different would be if the male person has adopted the child, and therefore the law has recognized them as the father. But in terms of actual being the father, that's typically what is meant. So, for example, a father figure is not father for purposes of family law discussions. That would typically be only either the biological father or the adoptive father, because only those are actual legal relationships. In terms of general, universally, first let's talk about the University of the United States, because every country is different, and we're in the United States, and most of our listeners are in the United States, and that's where I practice. So in the United States, to the best of my knowledge, all 50 states at this point in time, a biological father has an absolute right to have some sort of relationship with their child, just as, again, under the written law, a biological mother has some right to have some relationship with her child. Now, that's sort of a very bottom line default, and that right can be lost, and your parental rights can be terminated, but it's very difficult to do. And in fact, that's a question that we get quite often submitted over at, we have a website where you can submit questions to ask a lawyer, and one of them typically is, can I terminate the parental rights of my ex because he's a no-good so-and-so, or she's a drunk, or whatever the reason might be. One parent figures that they ought to be able to just essentially excommunicate the other parent from the child because they're a lousy parent. In reality, it's very, very difficult. In fact, the companion question to that typically is, can I terminate my own rights because I haven't been allowed to see my child in, you know, 15 years, and I don't feel like I should have to pay child support, or I worry they're going to come after me for child support, or whatever the case may be. And again, in that case, it's extremely difficult to have parental rights terminated. You cannot voluntarily give up your parental rights unless it's because the other parent's new spouse wants to adopt the child and you agree to that. And the reason for that is because with rights come responsibilities, and no state is going to let a parent off the hook from those responsibilities unless someone else is willing to step in. Now, again, there are extreme cases where parental rights can be terminated. Typically, those would be due to extreme abuse or abandonment where the child becomes under the state's care, either through welfare or through the foster care system or what have you. But so those basic universal rights, as you put it, Rob, have to do really with the right to have some sort of relationship, even if it's a supervised relationship, if there are issues. And with that go the twin responsibilities of you have to support your child.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling in, Rob. We appreciate that. That leads us right into Sam from Connecticut. Sam, you're on the air with Ann P. Mitchell.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Sam.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I have a question. I have a common child with a female who's not my wife, and there is some spousal abuse going on, actually from her to me, and at this point there's a restraining order against her, and I'm not sure where my daughter is. How should I deal with this?
All right, so when you say you have a common child, let me make sure I understand this. You have had a child with a woman who is not your wife, and you have a restraining order against her because she has been abusive to you, and she has taken off somewhere with the child. Do I have it right?
For all intents and purposes, she has not taken off, I don't believe. I mean, I don't know that, but I don't believe that she has.
Okay. Well, Sam, first of all, I want to tell you that I'm really sorry to hear of this situation, and I want you to know, and I think it's very important for our listeners to hear, that men being abused by women is much more common than anyone realizes, and that's for a few different reasons. First and foremost, men typically don't report it. They have been trained ever since they were little boys that you just don't admit to it when a girl beats you up. They are ashamed, they're embarrassed, and also they're worried that no one's going to believe them. And in fact, often that's the case, that people don't believe you. When you call the police in to a domestic violence call, even if the man has not laid a finger on the woman and the woman's done all the beating, first of all, the police go in there and they're trained. The first thing they have to do is someone has to go to jail because they have to remove someone from the house and get them apart so that they don't kill each other. And nine times out of 100, they are going to believe that it was the male who was the aggressor because that's just what our society thinks. In fact, and Brian, you asked the question very quickly, just to illustrate this point, I had a case in San Jose where my guy, and I only represent fathers, my guy was absolutely, I believe in my heart, he would never have lifted a hand, never have lifted a finger to this woman. And she aggressed him. He had claw marks. His face was bleeding from the claw marks raked down her cheeks. There was not a mark on her because he hadn't touched her, and still the police arrested him. And that's actually when he came to me, and we got that taken care of. But the point is that I'm really, really sorry to hear that you're on the receiving end of this, and it's really very common, and you say you have a restraining order, so I hope that means that you did in fact report it because that's the right thing to do. Now, with respect to your child, Sam, do you have any kind of order from the court having to do with timeshare and custody?
There is no order in force. We were actually living together. This only happened last Wednesday, so.
Okay. Have you had paternity adjudicated? Do you have anything besides a birth certificate saying that you're the father?
There was, you know, an issue with the court because the child was on the state-mandated insurance program, and the state child support got involved because they want me to provide insurance for her, which I have no problem with.
Right, right. Well, actually, in this case, that may have really been a help to you. Now, understand that I do not practice in Connecticut, so
okay.
I can only tell you what I know we would need to do if you were in California, but for the most part, most states are very similar. What you need to do is you need to go to the court. You need to say to them, look, I have already been proven to be the father of this child. Here's the paperwork. You're already having me pay. You recognize me as the father. She is not letting me see my child, and you need to open up a case in the family law court and have them give you at least a temporary order that provides for you to see your child. Now, were you my client, particularly given that she's already been demonstrated to be violent and because she's not letting you see the child, what I would do and what would work in California is I'd go in and I'd say we would like an order granting him emergency temporary custody of the child because she is keeping the child from him, whereas he will facilitate the child's relationship with her. And 9 times out of 10, you would get that temporary custody. So my advice to you would be to talk to a family law lawyer quickly in Connecticut and ask them, is this grounds in Connecticut for me to get temporary emergency custody? And in any event, we need to get an order because the most important thing for you to have right now, Sam, is an order that says you get to have your child with you on these particular days. And then if she does not give you access to your child on the days that are very clearly spelled out in the order, and that's why this is so important. The order has to be very specific. You know, the third and fourth Wednesdays of the month and every other weekend or every other week, whatever it is that you do, it has to be highly specific so that if she violates the order, the police can enforce it for you. And let me tell you, and everyone listening out there, Sam, if your order says that you are supposed to have your child with you on, let's say it's the third weekend of the month, and you try to get your child the third weekend of the month and that other parent won't let you have your child, that is parental kidnapping.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
Good luck, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
May I tell you what? This is really bringing out some interesting questions and situations that I guess, you know, God, millions of people must go through this every day.
Every single day, Brian. Count yourself lucky that you have a good, intact family and keep your wife happy.
Well, I was just about to say count myself lucky that I've got a great friend that's a father's right divorce attorney, just in case that ever comes up.
Who do we have up next, Brian?
We got Rodney from Milwaukee. Let's see. Rodney, you're on the line with Ann. What's your question?
Good evening, Ann, and to you, sir.
Hello there, Rodney. Welcome.
Thank you. My question is, I'm facing child support arrears, and
okay.
I am retired on a disability. And
okay.
I can tell you briefly the scenario. Back in 2007, I was brought back to court for child support arrears. Ironically, it was 2 weeks. I'm not for child support arrears, for child support modification, and it was 2 weeks before I got married. And it wasn't until 2008 that the new order for child support increase was enforced. So they went back to 2007, then brought it up to 2008, and which caused me to be in arrears just by that, by $14,000. And now, during 2008, my income was different from 2007, which did not allow me to pay the amount of child support that was asked. And so with that, I am now in arrears, and I'm wondering, I've already been to court, or we're going to be going back in October for a recalculation of the arrears. I'm wondering if my income taxes could help recalculate or would be enough sufficient evidence to recalculate the arrears and lower the arrears based on the income that was that I had worked that time, during that time.
Okay, so let me see if I understand the situation. You already had some arrears?
No.
Is that right? Okay, you didn't already have arrears. You had an order for child support.
Yes.
And then you got, you said something about getting married in there. I'm assuming it was to someone who was not the mother of your child.
Yes.
Okay. And then you were hit with arrears, but you were current for the order that you, as far as you knew?
Yes, ma'am. I was current. Until 2008, there was a request to increase the child support payments that I've been making to actually double the payments from $1,200 to $2,400. And they based that request on the income I made in 2007. I worked a lot of overtime. But in 2008,
okay,
that income was not the same as 2007.
Because you didn't have the overtime. Were you at the same job?
Yes, ma'am.
But you just didn't have the overtime.
No, the downsized the company downsized for the years 2008-2009, and it was in 2007 where I made a lot of money because of overtime.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, and so then there was a request for modification, and that happened in 2008, and then they decided to grant the modification, and as a result, you ended up with arrearages because of the new amount, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and when did that order for arrears, what year was that order was handed down?
2008, April of 2008.
It was handed, okay. And it was filed, the request for modification must have been filed months before that, right? Because they could only make it retroactive to the date when the request had been filed, right?
It was, yes, ma'am. It was requested in 2007.
Okay. So what they did was they made the modification retroactive back to the date that it was requested, and suddenly you had all these arrearages for all the months between when the order was filed and when the order was actually rendered.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, since that order happened, did you refile for another modification?
I attempted to refile for a modification, but because it was a tax intercept, the letter stated that I could not modify the child support. And if I want to add, also that I got a letter from the opposing attorney requesting that I send a letter to the judge stating that I am in dispute of this child support increase that they're asking. And I sent two letters to that judge, and there was no response.
Okay. All right. So that tells me a couple of things. First of all, Ryan, that tells me you're representing yourself.
Okay.
And that is the worst thing you can possibly do. You just... and let me tell you, am I right?
Yes,
are you representing yourself?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, let me tell you one of the dirty little secrets of family law court. Well, first of all, let me back up and tell you the first dirty little secret of family law court, because this is where men always, always get caught up. Family law court is not about justice, equity, or fairness. Most men go into family law court expecting, I'm going to go in there and I'm just going to tell the judge like it is because I'm being reasonable, and court is about fairness. And that is not what family law court's about. And partly for that reason, men cannot represent themselves. It is extremely rare for a man to come out of family law court having done well at all, but especially if he's representing himself. And part of that reason is he doesn't know how to play the game. But the other part of that reason is because the sad reality is, and here comes that dirty little secret, the court, the lawyers, the bailiffs, the clerks, and the judges, they don't like people who represent themselves. And the minute you walk in there representing yourself, you've got two strikes already against you.
Okay.
So, Rodney, what I need to tell you is, I don't, you know, if you have to beg, borrow, don't steal, because that's illegal, but whatever you have to do to get the money together to pay a lawyer, you need a lawyer, and you need one fast, because every single day that goes by that you haven't filed the right papers, that's more money that's accruing in those arrearages. Just like when they filed for the modification, that order was retroactive to the date they filed, The same thing is true for you. For you to stop the clock from ticking, you've got to get the right paperwork filed. And for that lawyer to tell you to write a letter to the judge, you know, it could be that that was a naive lawyer that really thought what they were saying was, you know, you need to tell the court, not me. But it could also be that that lawyer, if they're an old seasoned lawyer, they know darn well that your letter to the judge wasn't going to do a darn thing, because the judge isn't going to take a letter from a party. The judge wants properly submitted papers from a lawyer. And so that's what you need to do. Now, to your original question, which was, can you use your tax records to show what your actual income was? Absolutely you can. You absolutely can. And now here's what I'm going to tell you. When you do that, they are going to accuse you of suppressing your income. They're going to accuse you of reducing your income because they filed the modification. And they're also going to accuse you of making cash money under the table to suppress your income. So when you file those papers that you're going to do with that lawyer that you're going to get by begging or borrowing or doing whatever you have to do to get them, you make sure that you get a letter right up front from your employer explaining that in 2007 you had a lot of overtime, but in 2008 they downsized, and you know what? You are darn lucky to still have a job. You make sure that that employer puts that in there, that, you know, you're a valued employee, and that's why they kept you on, but 2008, it was just a different financial landscape for them, and that's the reason your income has dropped.
Okay, and that is definitely correct, and I just want to add, one, I am being represented right now, and we are pleased. I am pleased with this attorney. And I am right now retired from my job, which changed my income or the circumstance of my income. And also right now there are attempts to review the arrears. And like you said, with the tax income, and one of the things they did mention while I was working that I did suppress the income, but that was not the case. It was the overtime that was eliminated. The income remained the same. It was the overtime that was eliminated. So suppressing the income was not the case. It was the overtime that was no longer available.
Exactly, and your lawyer needs to make sure to really bring that to the attention of the court over and over, and that letter that you need to get from your employer, that will really help. Most states I know, certainly California, which is where I practice, like I said, but most of the states, as far as I know, they cannot penalize you because you worked overtime. In fact, many states will not allow child support modification based only on overtime, and you should have your lawyer check in to see whether Wisconsin's one of them, because it may be actually that that modification was improper, which would be a really nice thing for you to find out. Okay?
Okay. I'm sorry. If you could just repeat that real quickly, if you could, ma'am.
Sure. I'm going to let you take that on the air because we have to get to other callers, so I wish you well. But what I said was that your lawyer needs to emphasize to the court that that modification was based on overtime and that the court cannot hold you to have to continue working overtime, particularly if it's not available. But many states will not allow a modification based on overtime. And the reason is because essentially that's forcing the parent to continue to work overtime, which is voluntary. And so you should have your lawyer check to see if, in fact, Wisconsin does not allow modifications of child support based on overtime, because if so, then that modification may have been improperly granted, which means that possibly you could have it undone.
Okay.
Well, good luck to you, Rod.
Hey, just a reminder, if you guys are waiting in the call queue, hit 1 to let us know that you have a question for Ann. But now let's go to Monir in San Francisco. Monir, you're on the line with Ann.
Hello,
hi, Monir.
How are you doing?
Hi there. I'm very well, thank you. You're back in my old home area.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so
what can
I'm actually from the East Bay. So what happens is that I just came back from vacation and everything was fine. But the last 3 days of a vacation, we kind of had arguments because what happens is that my wife, actually, she was addicted to marijuana, and she does have a medical card, and we have a three-year-old child. And what happens is that there, after being there 2 weeks, she started to have the withdrawals. And so she just got in a really bad mood. And so when we got back, she decided she wanted a divorce. And so what happened is that the way she got her medical marijuana card, she got it by abusing the system. And mm-hmm. she told me basically about it. And what happens is that in the past, she used to smoke in the house and things like that in front of the baby. And so I was just wondering if there was anything I could do about it. And also, I'm sorry, go ahead. And also my son is also also allergic to animals, and we've had here at some point of time like about 16 animals, and he's just covered in pimples and rashes and things like that because of the animals. And we didn't file for anything yet, so she just left the house. And mm-hmm. so what happens is that whenever he comes back, because she has so many animals, he just gets rashes all over his body. And I was wondering if there was anything I could do about this.
Well, you know, you raised some really interesting questions, and it's always, you know, I'm sorry to say that, because what that means is it's interesting for the lawyers, but maybe not so, you know, interesting for you. You know, medical marijuana, that is such a new animal, no pun intended, such a new thing that's going on in this country that, to the best of my knowledge, there is no real case law on that, because unlike other medications where you can just say, well, be sure to keep it away, you know, locked away, keep the pills locked away, with marijuana, there's the smoke and there's the secondhand smoke. And there is some discussion in the cases on secondhand smoke in the case of where a child is sick. You know, I have seen orders in that case where if, for example, a child has asthma, you know, the order might be that you can't smoke around the child because the secondhand smoke's bad for them. But again, medical marijuana, that's a very new issue. And frankly, I am unaware of anything that's actually on point with regard to that. But that said, you know, it's not entirely dissimilar from the other issue you raised, which is that you have a child who is sick, is allergic to animals, and there are a lot of animals around. And now, let me ask you this. So your wife, you say you haven't filed anything. Is she just out of the house now? Is she living somewhere else?
Yeah, she's living with her friend. So she's living with someone who's also divorced.
Okay. And you're in the house where all the animals are?
Well, actually, at my house, she took all of her animals. She took them all out with her. So all of her animals live with her at her friend's. So at the house here, there's absolutely no animals, and it's very clean now. I mean, it used to be pretty unclean, I would say, here.
And did you, and the children, they are seeing both of you? You're both able to have access to the children? She's not keeping you from them, and you're not keeping them from her?
No. We were able to share, basically.
Okay, Okay, let me tell you a couple of things. The first thing is you have to be extremely careful as a father to pick your fights very, very carefully. And here's the reason why. Very often you will, as parents are trying to figure out their new roles and they're trying to have their rules when the kids are at their house, and they want to do the best thing for the kids, and they get really upset when things happen at the other house that they feel is not good for the children, and which I know may not be good for the children. And the typical example is what they get to eat or what they get to watch on television. And in this case, it will extend to some extent to the animals. Here's what happens when a father goes to court and says, I'm very concerned because of what happens at her house. And then whatever that thing is, whether it's what they're eating or what they're watching or the animals, whatever, what the court hears is, I'm an angry, controlling man, and I'm trying to control my wife. Because that's what the wife's attorney is going to tell them. And because that's what they have heard from women's lawyers since time immemorial. And so it's super, super important to pick your fights to make sure that it's something that you really feel is that important that you're willing to risk the court having a backfire on you, essentially. Now, what I'm hearing that in your case, these are unhealthy activities. Certainly, smoking marijuana around your children, I would say that's not a healthy activity. And if the animals are actually making your child sick, that's also not a healthy activity. And so it may not be as bleak as I've just spelled out as being sort of what the traditional thing that would happen would be. It may be in your case that there really is a case to be made that your child should not be around that many animals, at least for an extended period of time. But the only way to know that is if a doctor would actually say that that's the case. And so what I would recommend for you is talk to a lawyer in your area. And because you're in my old stomping grounds, I'm actually about to give you the name and phone number of an absolutely incredible lawyer in the East Bay. He will absolutely know. In fact, of anyone I know, he may be one of the only lawyers that would know more about the medical marijuana issue as well. So I would go to a lawyer, and I would tell them these are your concerns, and then I would have them, first of all, you need to file something. Unfortunately, you can't get any orders from a court unless you actually have filed an action. So you either need to file a divorce action or you need to file a separation action. That's pretty unusual to do, because if you're going to do that, you might as well file the divorce action, which is where you have to end up anyway. And once that action is filed and you get some temporary orders in place for who gets the children with them when, I would look at having a medical evaluation of your child in terms of having the animals around them. But whatever you do, you don't want to go off kind of half-cocked into the court and just sort of make a whole bunch of accusations about how unhealthy it is. You absolutely need to have some sort of medical finding to back you up. So it's not you being an angry dad trying to control your ex-wife. It's the doctor saying this is not healthy for the child. So, Muneer, do you have a pen?
Yes, I do.
Okay. All right. This attorney's name is Frank. His last name is Presto, like Presto Changeo. And his number is 510. Actually, no, I take that back. He has a new number. His number is 925-846-4006. And it's 925-846-4006. All right? I'm going to let you go now because we have the switchboard's lit up like a Christmas tree, but give Mr. Presto a call, and he can answer any other questions you have.
Hi, there's some really interesting topics that are popping up. I guess you've seen probably everything, but, you know, what a heartbreak.
I hope I have.
What a heartbreak as a father to have your children potentially be suffering and not really able to do anything about it. That's got to be tough. Next, we have Lauren in Maryland. I may have mispronounced that, but you're on the air with Ann Mitchell.
Hi, Lauren.
Lauren, are you there?
I hear him talking, but I can barely hear him.
Well, he may have given up on us. Let's go to Tom in Denver. Tom, you've got a question for Ann. Go ahead.
Yeah, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Oh, I'm a mess. I'm going through a pretty nasty divorce. I mean, like every cliche in the book that you can imagine. We had court on Thursday. It was a status conference. I mean, my ex is dragging her heels, won't go to her parenting after divorce class, won't go to mediation. I filed contempt charges, which were granted. I was late to court, and they dismissed the charges. I was late because of construction in the courthouse, pretty much. They moved the court to another building across the way, and by the time I got there, she had just dismissed the case, so they set it again for Thursday. And my ex is making all kinds of wild allegations, abuse, and I don't know what to do. The judge ordered us to get him a regular pediatrician because I just moved, so I hadn't set that up yet. So she was like, get him a pediatrician because I have the insurance, agree on it, and get him in as soon as you can. And she was like, well, I'm just going to take him into the urgent care and the hospital. And she's like, no, you don't need to do that, but you do need to get him in as soon as possible. So I got home, immediately emailed her a list of a couple doctors, and she pretty much said, screw you, I'm taking him to urgent care anyways. Said, well, that's not what the judge said, but at least let me know which one. And she never did. I didn't hear from her. I was actually supposed to get my son yesterday at 6. We trade off every day. And she had gone camping for the holiday weekend, and at noon yesterday I received an email from her saying that she was about an hour and a half away in a national forest, and that's where I had to go pick up my son. And I tried getting a hold of her. She was already out of range, back to the campsite or whatever. I wrote her an email saying, hey, when you get back into town, let me know. I'm not driving all the way up there by myself. Her boyfriend's probably all talk, but I've already filed a police report due to threatening phone calls and that nature. But, you know, I'm not going to go drive by myself into a forest with these people. You know, probably nothing but just a bad idea. So I wrote her an email, told her that. And then I finally picked up my son today at 6. He was acting really weird. He kept saying sorry, and he said that he was bad, and he said he lied, and I didn't know what he was saying. And then I get another email when I get home from picking him up saying that she took him to the doctor today and that she has proof of abuse and this and that, and, you know, I just don't know where to go. I don't have money for an attorney. I don't know if I should call social services myself and say, hey, my wife is making all these allegations. I want somebody to investigate. I have no idea.
Tom, do you have a good lawyer?
Yeah.
No,
I don't have a lawyer.
Okay.
I'm unemployed right now.
I'm going to tell you this straight up. You have to find a way to get a lawyer or you're going to lose your son. It's that simple. You're dealing with someone who's making false allegations of abuse. You're dealing with someone who is going to go the distance to do whatever she can to interfere with your relationship with your child. You don't have the luxury. Right.
She's taking him for weeks and months at a time from me. Like,
okay.
The only reason we finally have paperwork in court was she said I wasn't going to see him again until I got a court order.
Right. So you know that what I'm saying is true. I'm sorry you're unemployed, and I'm sorry how hard it is. So what I would recommend to you, first of all, contact the law schools in the area. There's one at CU Boulder. I think there is at least one in Denver. Again, I'm not that familiar with the lay of the land here yet about those things. But try contacting the law schools to see if they have a legal clinic, and if they don't, ask them to refer you to one. Also contact the Colorado State Bar Association and ask them if they have what's called a modest means panel or any kind of a law clinic that does a sliding scale. But that's where to start.
Because I tried to apply for, like, I forget what the name of the organization was, but I made really good money before I was unemployed, so even on unemployment, you know, I was clearing 800 in 2 weeks, but that's,
okay,
I mean,
so
it's enough to get by, but.
So this is what you need to do. You need to start there. Start calling the law schools. Start calling the local legal aid societies. Someone out there, you know, is going to help you to get a lawyer. You have to have a lawyer, and you need to do this really quickly because it's only going to get worse. And Tom, listen, I want you to give Brian, my producer, your email address, and I'm going to mail you a copy of my book, which includes how to deal with false allegations. I'm sorry to rush off, but we've got a ton of people, and really, you need a lawyer.
All right, very good. Man, we are just lighting up the switchboard here, Ann. This is pretty exciting. We're going to jump to a female caller. I don't know if this is going to – you said that you've been called a traitor to your gender, so I'm not sure which way this call is going to go. But we'll see how it goes.
I'm ready.
Tina in Tennessee. Tina, you're on the air with Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Tina. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I'm calling for my husband. We have an interstate child support issue. My husband's son is 18 now, and his current support is actually over, but we're fighting arrearages in Georgia. My husband was divorced in Georgia back in 1994, and was ordered to pay $75 a week in support. A year later, he moved to Tennessee and got behind about $3,000. Georgia sent a uniform support petition under ERISA law to Tennessee and requested that Tennessee both enforce and modify the existing child support order, and Tennessee complied. They changed the child support, modified the child support from $75 down to $65, which included $10 a week going towards the arrearages, and they offset my husband's income taxes for the arrearages. My husband always paid his support for the entire, up until my stepson was 18, and the current support ended, but yet Georgia's claiming that we owe, or my husband owes $15,000 in arrearages, and they're refusing to recognize the uniform support petition and the modifications that Tennessee made at Georgia's request. And I don't understand how they can request modifications be made and then not recognize them.
Okay, so Georgia requested modification, probably expecting that it was going to increase, and instead it decreased. And
right.
Now Georgia is saying, well, you still owe all this money based on the Georgia order, as if the modification never happened. Is that right?
Exactly.
All right. Here's what I'm going to guess. Obviously, I don't see the paperwork. I don't, you know, so this is just a guess based on my own experiences and what is most likely. Whenever you have two different agencies, even when you have two different branches of the same agency involved, the opportunity for miscommunication or a failure of communication is huge. So my best guess is that once that modification was done in Tennessee, that information, while it may or may not have gotten back to Georgia when it needed to, probably never got entered properly back in Georgia, because it doesn't really make sense otherwise. Now, do you have any reason to know that I'm wrong about that?
No, I don't. We disputed it with Georgia, and they basically told us that they're following UIFSA law or something like that. They're not following the ERISA law. The order was the modifications were filed under ERISA law, but they're claiming that the law changed and they don't have to follow ERISA law anymore.
Okay, and so what does your lawyer say?
We cannot afford an attorney. We are struggling just to keep our house right now. That's why these arrearages are so hard on us. We did file a dispute with the local child support office in Tennessee. She faxed a copy to Georgia and said that we do not owe them, because it's in plain black and white that Georgia requested Tennessee to modify them. They're just giving us the runaround. We've written letter after letter and disputed and disputed. We requested a hearing in Georgia. They refused to give us a hearing. We don't know what to do, and we cannot afford an attorney. We've tried to find low-income lawyers. We don't even qualify for that. There's no law schools that will accept us.
All right. Well, here's what I'm going to recommend, and hopefully you haven't already done this, because this is kind of the one thing that I can think of that if you haven't done might really help. All right.
Okay.
First of all, you need someone in Georgia, not Tennessee. Because Georgia doesn't give a darn what someone in Tennessee said. So, contact the department in the district attorney's office in the jurisdiction in Georgia.
Okay.
And ask them for help. Now, they probably won't flat out help you, but they will at least be able to put you on the right track. Because what you need is a person in Georgia who can look at your file, see where Georgia asked Tennessee to do that, and then see that Tennessee did it and tell you what you need to do. And the only person who can do that is someone who is in that Georgia court system, who is familiar with the Georgia court system. And if you can't get through to anyone in the DA's office, and for everyone listening, this is really one of the first places to start is call the clerk of the court. Whatever court is issuing the order that's causing you heartache, call the clerk of court and ask them, who do I need to talk to? What do I need to do? Now, again, in most cases, you need a lawyer. Now, I'm not talking to you about that right now, Tina, because I hear your situation, and because all the orders already happened, I think you can get a good start with calling the DA's office, the Child Support Enforcement Division of the DA's office in Georgia. But for any question where you're not sure where to start, the clerk of court is going to be a gold mine. They have all the information you need, and if they don't, they can usually tell you where to call.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Good luck to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay.
All right. Next, we've got, I think, our caller, which is exciting. I don't know how that affects the law or not, but Musa in Vancouver, you're on the line with Ann Mitchell.
Hey. Hi. There.
Hi.
Hi. I got to tell you right now, I got to give you that disclaimer that I'm a U.S. attorney, so I can give you some, you know, common sense ideas, but I'm not going to really tell you much about Canadian law.
I know that. It's just I need some feedback. I'm going through separation. We were married for 15 years. We have three children, 14 and 11 and 6. And it's been financially disheartening and an unbelievable journey over the last 2 years. She is getting two-thirds of my income. I'm still paying all the family debt, and that was part of our breakup, was the huge debt that accrued over time, and she wouldn't go back to work because she wanted to homeschool the kids and all that. And I was, I went along with it in the beginning. I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. And as debts accrued, and I said, you know, we need part-time, we need something. I can't do this. Vancouver is really expensive on one income.
Uh-huh.
A teacher's salary is just, you know, going nowhere. And so, you know, she spoke to lawyers, and recently she gave me a little paper basically stating this is what I'm going to settle for. I've been told I can go 75% of the assets and pick up only about 35% or 40% of the debts, and or not even, because it's all in your name. And
uh-huh.
I'm thinking, you know, what do I do? I sought out lawyers, and I paid, you know, quite a chunk of change to somebody I thought that was going to be, you know, they've had 20-some-odd years experience in this and that, and what I got was no more than I could have had from a therapist for free. And I thought, I can't do this, because all they wanted to do was, okay, do you want to retain me? Well, I don't have $7,000 or $10,000 right away to retain. And I don't seem to qualify for anything because I make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, well, I may make that amount on paper, but I'm actually living on less than $2,000 a month, and that's got to take care of everything. And then I'm hit with, you know, kids being with me and going out and this and that, and them saying, you know, can you get us this? Can you get us that? And I say, no, sweetie, you know, I gave money to Dad. Well, you're never going to buy us anything, are you?
So I hear the frustration and the inequity. What do you have a question for me?
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is, and then, you know, we were married for 15 years. How long is the support payment supposed to be for the spouse? For the children, I know they're till 19, and I'm fine with that. But she's getting a huge amount, and was supposed to be for the first 2 years. With the family law counselor, she said, you know, you're supposed to go back to work, find retraining and all that, and she hasn't done any of that. And I get this letter stating, you know, I hope the support payments continue indefinitely, and then I'm entitled to your pension, half of it, for the time that we're together. And
so here's the thing. Let me tell you. Now, I can tell you from here in the States.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's in California, for example, there's a rule of thumb when it comes to spousal support, and that rule of thumb is a short-term marriage, which is anything under say 3 years, then.
Right.
Pretty much you get a half month for every month you were married.
Right.
And then a long-term marriage, which is anything over, say, 10 years, you're pretty much on the hook indefinitely unless they remarry. And then in between is some gray area there. And so from by that standard, you would, in fact, be on the hook for paying spousal support pretty much indefinitely. But now, that said, there has been a trend, and California has adopted this trend, to say that spousal support, the purpose of spousal support is to help the supported spouse to get back on their feet, whether they need to go back to school to retrain or whatever they need to do, so that it will not be indefinitely, or so that it will at least diminish the amount, because the more they earn, the less you have to pay. And that's the trend in most of the states. And so I have to believe that Canada, which is certainly by no means a backward country, in some states, in some ways much more progressive than our states, I would have to imagine that in your legal code, that somewhere in there it says something to the same effect, which is the purpose of spousal support is to help the spouse to get on their feet.
Yeah.
Now, that said, I heard you say that she wants to homeschool, and homeschooling means not...
She wants to continue...
Right.
And then decide, you know, when she's ready, she may come back possibly part-time or, you know, full-time.
Okay.
But like she said, by that time, I won't have any time to build anything, so I'm entitled to your pension and I'm
right
too. And I'm thinking this is...
So here's what I want to tell you. You will never, and I don't care what country this is, this is true. This is a universal truism across all countries. You will never, as a father, do better in court than you can do by staying out of court. Now, what's important to her? The reality is, for women, what's important is getting whatever they can financially. And you can't blame them for that, because we as women have been told forever that when we go to family law court, we're going to get screwed. Pardon my French, but that's what we're told. And, you know, and that the paradigm is that the women get the kids and the men get to pay, and the men are going to try to not pay, so get everything you can. That's what we're told. That's what all our friends are telling us. That's what our family's telling us. That's even what the family law court, in not so many words, is telling us. So it's important for you to understand that what she's concerned about is not getting shafted financially. She's worried that you're going to try and shaft her out of what she thinks she's entitled to. Now, on your end, you're just trying to be reasonable, and you want to make sure you have a good relationship with your kids, and you don't want to end up in the poorhouse. But by understanding her concerns, you can start to figure out creative ways to offer her things that will help her to be less concerned about that. Now, this, I'm going to give you an example that from my own practice. This example does not necessarily apply to you, but it gives you an idea of what I'm talking about. For example, when typically, at least here in the States, when there is an issue where dad wants more time with the kids and the mom is not letting him have more time with the kids, and she's saying, you're just trying to control me and you don't want to pay as much child support, blah, 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 I tell my guys, look, if you can afford to continue paying her the amount of support you're paying now, even if you get the kids with you more so you would be entitled to pay less, do this. Offer her. Say, hey, you know what? I understand you're worried about money. Money's tight and you're not sure, you know, what your income's going to be. I understand that. So tell you what, if you let me have the kids with me for a greater amount of time, I won't ask to lower child support. Now, that may not make sense right away, but if you think about it, what it does is it completely takes the wind out of their sails about, oh, well, you're just trying to reduce child support. And it also shows the court you are bending over backwards to be fair and reasonable. You just really want time with your kids. Now, again, I'm not saying that applies to your situation, but it's an example of how to think creatively to address what the unstated concern is and address that so that you can get to where you want to be. Now, in your case, your concern really is money, because she wants to homeschool and she's not working and she's already said that she wants you to support her forever and she wants her pension and everything else. So what does that translate to? That translates to she's worried that she's not going to be financially taken care of.
Yeah.
Right. So your job is to think of ways that you can offer her some arrangements that will address that, but also address your concerns. And that could look like a couple of different things. It could look like, hey, how about we agree that for the first X years, I'll pay you this amount regardless of what you're doing, and that gives you the peace of mind that you can continue homeschooling and there's no pressure on you. But then after the third year, you know, when our kids are older, then that will drop off a bit, but you're going to get some this part of this asset. I mean, there's ways to work it that make you seem very reasonable and also can address her concerns. And your job is to creatively figure out how to craft that offer. And then equally important is come up with at least three different offers, options, and put them on the table, any of them which you know you could live with, remembering that if you go to court, you're going to be paying the lawyers all of your assets anyway. So you might as well figure out a way to keep some of them and let your kids get them or her get some of it rather than the lawyers. Come up with three different creative options and let her choose, because that way she feels like she's still got some control and say over it. You don't care which one she chooses. They're all going to be better for you than what you're going to get out of the court. But that way she feels like she has the final say. Okay?
Okay. Do you have anybody that you may know of, or someone who knows of somebody who would work in the same realm in Vancouver, British Columbia?
What I would suggest is this, and we should have already put this site out on the air, and it's absolutely my fault. Brian didn't even know any better because I never told him. But if you go to my website at dadsrights.org, there should be a way to look up there. I don't know, to be honest, if we have Canadian lawyers on there right now. So what I'm going to do is I am, in fact, going to have Brian get your email address, because I have two names. They are not in Vancouver, but they're at least in Canada, and they may be able to refer you to someone else. Okay? Oh.
Oh, well, he's gone. All right. So I guess he got the information that he wanted. Let's head south a bit to the Windy City of Chicago. And Dave has an interesting question for Ann. Dave, what's your question for Ann Mitchell?
Hi, Dave in Chicago. How are you?
Okay, Ann. How you doing? Happy Labor Day.
I got to tell you what. You are in the town that has my favorite pizza place in the entire world. How far are you from Giordano's?
Which one? There's you know what? You come down, I can get you there within 20 minutes, either any location.
It's a deal. I got to tell you what, Brian, Giordano's pizza is the most amazing pizza ever. Anyway, Dave, what can I do for you?
I got two questions. One, how do I go about getting my ex-wife to stop taking our son, our 12-year-old son, to a psychiatrist because she thinks that there's something wrong with them when there isn't? It's a long-standing situation. And two, how do I go about I like the phone caller you had here before, with all the different scenarios and giving the woman options. She's claimed the children for the last 3 years on taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out a way to, you know, give her an option, saying, hey, how about you claim them on the even years, I claim them on the odd years, or I just claim our son, you claim the girls. You know, how do I go about doing that? And with my son, he's been seeing a psychiatrist and been taking medicines for the last 3 or 4 years. It started off with, you know, we went through a whole array of questions with the school districts and with doctors. The thing is, what really bothered me is when I got the pamphlet and the questionnaire, and I was asked, you know, how does our son act at this point in time? Do you have any troubles? I said I had nothing wrong. And I gave it to the school nurse and to the psychiatrist. She did the same thing, but I believe someone gave her my answers, which is actually a HIPAA violation, but, you know, because she's not supposed to find out what I said. And before I know it, he's on 1, 2, 3 different medications and seeing a psychiatrist.
Okay, now, do you guys live in the same town, or...?
No. Actually, we were living in South Carolina, and because work was so scarce in South Carolina, I moved up to Chicago, where we were originally from, to get employment. And I've been, you know, I've been blessed to have a steady employment for like the last year and a half.
Okay. Are you seeing your kids?
I see them once in a while. I talk to them practically every day or text them every day.
Okay. All right. I got to tell you that from across the states, you know, not being even in the same state, it's going to be really tough. So I'm going to tell you what you could do if you were in the same state. In the same state, what you would do is you would file a court action requesting that the court appoint a psychological evaluator to evaluate everybody, okay? To evaluate your son because, you know, you want a neutral person to do that, but also to evaluate the mom because, you know, now you've only told me a tiny bit, so I certainly can't diagnose her, but it's entirely possible that you're looking at a not that uncommon situation called Munchausen syndrome by proxy. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but what that is that's where a parent, typically it's a parent-child situation where the parent continually has to believe the child there's something wrong with them so that they can take them to the doctor to fix them.
Well, you know, what kills me is that this has been going on for 3 or 4 years. She did take them to a church psychiatrist and to another psychiatrist, but what bothers me, she did this in like 2005, 2006. I didn't find out until like 2007, 2008. The kids did not say anything to me. You know, it was almost like hush, hush, hush. And I'm like, personally, I know I'm on radio right now. It's kind of like I hate to say a child abuse thing, but you don't do that to kids. Okay.
Right.
To anybody, you don't do that.
Well, so unfortunately, again, you're kind of, you know, from in Chicago, that's going to be a really hard thing for you to do. You really need to be able to be in North Carolina and to file that action. That's what you would do there. The second best thing is from Chicago is to get a lawyer in North Carolina to represent you, to file the paperwork, to request the evaluation, because that's the only way you're going to be able to stop this is to have the court intervene and have a court order saying, stop taking the kid to the psychiatrist. You know, the reality is after 4 years of going to a shrink when they didn't need to, he probably needs to. You know, again, I get that you have a job in Chicago. And, you know, it's not like it's easy for me to say go to North Carolina when your job is in Chicago. But, again, if that's not an option for you, then what you need to do is get a lawyer, a good lawyer in North Carolina, and recognize that you're going to have to travel to North Carolina for court appointments and for psychiatric evaluations. But that's going to be your pretty much your only bet of getting her to stop this unless you think you can creatively come up with it. Now, with respect to the income tax issues, I'm assuming that your court order says that she has primary physical custody. Is that right?
Says we have joint custody. Joint legal. She's custodian for the children. We never agreed on any type of tax basis, but that's the way it's always been.
You don't have to agree on a tax basis. Whoever has physical custody of the child in the order gets the tax write-off, and that's just how it is. That is the tax law, and it's unfair as all get out, but that is how it is. Now, when I craft, and again, I always keep my guys out of court whenever possible, because as I said to the caller in Canada, to Musa, men never do better in court than they do with what they can arrange out of court, and I always draft it so that if there's one child, they alternate tax years, and if there's two kids, they just split it or they alternate them both, because you can absolutely agree to anything. But yeah, but unfortunately, if you've got an order that gives her primary physical custody, that tax write-off is hers. But now that said, as you said, you know, you heard talk about being creative, there may still be ways that you can come up with that. And, you know, for example, if it turns out that you'd get more back on the tax return than she gets because of being able to take the deduction, you know, maybe you can offer to split that with her. Say, hey, give me the tax deduction every other year. I'm going to get a bigger return because of it, and I'm going to give you some of that. So you're not really going to be out that much. That's, you know, but so get creative with her. And you know what? If you can start getting creative with her first, you know, that may pave the way to you having dialogues directly with her about, look, could you maybe ease off on the whole psychological thing? But otherwise, you're going to have to get a lawyer in North Carolina. And I'm getting the sign now that we have to move on. But good luck to you.
All right. Well, let's keep going through our calls so we can hopefully get through everybody before the night is over. We've got Leon. in New York. Leon, you're on the air with Ann. What's your question?
Hey, thank you very much. How are you, Ann?
Hey, good evening, Leon. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, too, thanks. I have a, I guess everyone's issue is a pretty complex issue. Mine right now, the question I have at hand is about getting custody of my two boys. They live out of state. They've been out of state since 2003. And I'm pretty much wondering, how can I put together a case to attempt to get custody? And I've tried in the past with a lawyer. I've also tried without lawyers. And it seems like whether I do it with a lawyer or without a lawyer, I never seem to get over that hump. So this is what's basically happening now. At one point they were getting spankings, and when I found out about that and going to court in Virginia, I was able to get that stopped, at least as far as I know. Their father was spanking them, their uncle was spanking them. They would tell me that, you know, it hurts really, really bad. Their ages right now is 11 and 8, so this was going on when they were younger, like maybe 6 and, like, you know, 4. You know, mm-hmm. So maybe a year or two back, I got that to finally stop. Now, they're having to do some military-type punishments where they got to hold cans out with their arms stretched out straight, and if their arms drop, or if they drop their, like, cans or something, they get popped. And I think that's kind of crazy to be doing to our children. Number two issue that I have right now with how my kids are being brought up is, it pertains to the money. You know, I mean, I give a pretty good amount of money for the support of my children through the courts, and my kids aren't allowed, or they aren't being put into any kind of, you know, activities that I think is important for children to be raised in, like, you know, going to, you know, sports, music, chess club. I taught my kids how to play chess when they were very young. There's a bunch of things that I think that they can be doing with the money that I'm sending. But pretty much they go to school and they come home and they're playing games, video games, and that's it. I don't understand how, if the courts are all about the best interests of the children, and I'm a guy who's going into the courtroom saying that I'm going to get my kids involved in a lot of different things that are positive, how something like that can't be another issue that I can bring up.
Go ahead, be quick.
Another thing is that I pay for their dental, medical, vision care. They never go to the dentist. It basically seems like I took them to the dentist one time when I had them in the summertime. My older guy had 3 cavities. One of them was really big. Then they said that there was a chance that he would have had to have done a baby root canal, and that didn't have to happen. But, you know, again, it shows that there's some neglect going on there. And I also feel that, you know, their minds are being warped and, you know, kind of, you know, daddy doesn't love you kind of a thing, and that kind of crap is going on. So it just seems like, you know, if the mother's not completely just whacked out, you know, these are issues that the court doesn't seem to think is really important, because as long as the mother's getting money and the kids grow up to work in Mickey D's, they feel like they've done their job. And I'm basically asking you, do I have a case here to try to get custody of my kids?
All right, let me ask you this. How long has she had custody?
She's always had custody.
Okay,
we were
so
never married.
How long?
We were never married. Like I said, my oldest guy is 11, the youngest one is 8.
Okay, so you were never, so she's had them in her custody their entire lives?
Yep. Okay. I'd say maybe there was a year where we all lived in the same house, but that was
okay. All right, and the custody, you have she has an order for custody, right? This is
there's an order, there's a support order.
All right. First of all, I'm going to answer your questions in reverse order. And thank you very much for the call, because you raised some very important issues. And so the first thing that I want to say to you is, I understand your heart must absolutely be breaking to think of your children undergoing that kind of, those kinds of punishments or character builders, depending on how they look at it. Because I hear you, and I hear that that's not something you agree with. And I really feel for you. When it comes to how the money is used, you're absolutely right that you have no say in it. The court will never give you a say in it, and the court doesn't really care. The money is for, even though it child support's for the children, it is, it's given to the custodial parent with the assumption that the parent will do the best thing for the children. Now, you and I both know that that may not actually be what happens, and of course, reasonable minds can differ about what's best for the kids. And I hear you that if you had them, you would put them in chess club and you would do all these things, and now you feel like they're just, not using that money for that. But the reality is you're absolutely right. The court will not care about that at all. And so to bring that up to the court, as I mentioned to an earlier caller, will just make you seem like you're trying to control your ex. When in a sense you are, but in the most benevolent sense, you're trying to make sure your kids have all the, the best opportunities. But the reality is the court will not care, and it will only get the court angry at you if you try and bring that up. Generally speaking, absent abuse or something other that problematic, changing custody is very difficult to do, even under the best of circumstances. So that, first of all, the courts always want to keep the status quo. Partly it's because they just don't want to upset kids. If the kid's getting along okay, then uprooting them, that's a big upheaval, and that can be deleterious to the children. It doesn't mean it is, especially if they're going to go to a better, arguably a better place. But that's the reason that the courts will always opt to maintain the status quo, again, absent abuse. Typically, especially as a father, the reality is the only way you're going to get a change of custody contested through the court is if you can prove abuse, or you can prove she's, turning tricks in front of the kids while she's shooting drugs up. I mean, it really has to be that egregious. And so, unfortunately, I am going to tell you that your odds are pretty slim. Now, that said, it's entirely possible that what they are doing rises to the level of abuse. And I can't know that. I'm not there. I'm not sure how you're getting the information, if you're getting it from the kids or you're hearing it from someone else. But your best bet in this case would be to get a Virginia lawyer and talk to a Virginia lawyer, and not just any Virginia lawyer, but a Virginia lawyer who is right in that same area, so that they will know how the court would view this thing. Okay, every court has a different personality. It's driven by the judges, it's driven by the local mores and, what's considered acceptable, the norms. And so it's really important, particularly if you're trying to do something long distance, and this goes to our previous caller too, who's got kids in North Carolina, he's in Chicago. It's important to talk to a lawyer who works in that system where the kids are, so that you can know how is that court going to view this? Because it might not be the same way the court where you are would view it. All right, Brian, okay. Who do we have next?
Well, we're winding down. We want to really say thank you to everybody that's held on the phone for so long. We've just had an amazing amount of callers, and a lot of people have been waiting for a long time, and we appreciate that. Next up, we've got Barry from Spokane. Barry, you're on the air with Ann.
Hello,
Hello
Ann.
There, Barry. How are you?
Well, actually, not very good, and I called in the program quite a while ago, actually, but that's okay.
I'm sorry. It's
kind of,
been crazy.
Well, no. It's a big problem, man. And actually, I listened to you, and I thought, man, the lady sounds nice, but I think she thinks the courts work, and they don't work, man.
I know that.
Actually, they do work for making them and their comrades money, as far as I'm concerned. The callers that you spoke with, I've got pretty much a story about, my story is every one of theirs put together, except that they left out rape, death, forgery, Munchausen, she's a nurse, that's 50% of it, but they don't care about my kids. The one caller was scared to say that they're child abusers. I'm not saying, not only am I not saying that my kids' mom is not a child abuser, the psychologist is a child abuser, the judges are child abusers, and some of the lawyers are too. I do know some good ones here in town, but still, $100,000 and I can't even see my kids. I don't even know where they're at. you know, none of the people looked at the paperwork. My, she says my kids are liars and thieves, tells them that I'm this and that and the other. I mean, it's ridiculous out there.
It is. I never said that the courts work. In fact, if you were listening, you heard me say several times, I always try and keep my guys out of court.
Well, no, I heard that, and I go, well, that's pretty good. But, you know, the first time, my first lawyer, she kept me out of court, and come to find out, the mom forged a sperm donor contract and said that I donated my sperm, and she artificially inseminated herself because she's a nurse. And it only gets better.
So,
there.
Barry, do you have a question for me?
Well, yeah. Like I said, I haven't seen my kids. The mom took off with the kids and moved. She made them tell a psychologist that I touched them down there, but yeah, then the stories escalated, and she forged some paperwork with them and all that. I mean, she's crazy. But if you think it's worth spending $500 more to file contempt on her for, you know, leaving, well, I don't know where she's at, but she took the kids and went, because I'm still trying to get to see my kids and to get custody of them, because she's out to lunch.
Now, you know what? I do not think you should spend any money filing contempt on her, because for the most part, the family law court, and you probably already know this, they really don't care about that. They don't care about perjury in family law court. They don't really care usually about contempt, but I do think it's worth filing parental kidnapping charges against her. If you have an order that you are supposed to be able to see the kids and she took them away from you, then she's parentally kidnapped those kids.
Well, the psychologist said that I couldn't see him for a while, but I've took every test because I have a clear conscience, Ann, and I've never done anything wrong. I've fought CPS and won. I've fought the police and won. I've passed polygraph, psychological evaluations and everything. I mean, they're just making me spend money. That's all they're doing, and that's what they want. I filed custodial interference because she wouldn't let me see my kids. The judge didn't care. He had her daughter who she was trying to get off OxyContin, so she's taking methadone. The daughter gave it to a boy and killed him, but the judge didn't care about that. He more cared that I smoke weed once in a while. I mean, because I'm a terrible person if you smoke weed occasionally, Aaron. You know, but it's okay to take kids away from their dads and send them all over. My kids have been going to psychologists for 5 years.
First of all, I absolutely feel for you. And second of all, I want to tell you that I actually was involved in a case that was extremely similar to this, and I will tell you it didn't have a good outcome. It had a better outcome for what we ended up, you know, at least on one level once we got involved. But, you know, once you're in that deep, you know, any outcome is not going to be as perfect as it could have been had it never all, you know, none of this had ever all gone down. So what I want to do is I'm going to give you the name and phone number of an absolutely incredible, she's an MFCC, which in California it stands for Marriage, Family, and Children's Counselor. And I did a lot of work with her on cases involving false allegations of abuse. And I have a feeling that if anyone could give you some good advice as to what to do next, short of filing contempt charges, it would be her. So would you, I'm going to give this information to Brian, my producer, and then he can give you that information, all right?
I want to thank you because, you know, it takes common sense to realize that there is a problem and you are trying to fix it and you're bucking the system. You know, she assaulted me and I called the cops on her after a few different times because I warned her. They wanted to arrest me for being parked in her driveway for trespassing. I mean, it's a rigged game, and the male is always going to lose. It's to the point where I'm ready to just say, hey, I'm paying nothing. Because I feel like I'm paying for my children to be abused, and I'm going to, you know, go downtown, get a sign, and just say, I'm not paying for shit no more. I mean.
All right, Barry.
We're going to have to kill him there. This is a family show, ladies and gentlemen, so we need to keep the language appropriate.
Okay, we don't want to kill him, though.
We don't want to kill him. Mute him.
Go ahead. Would you please give him Ms. Mark's information?
Yeah. Yeah, Barry, hang on the line. We'll get the info to you in just a minute. We've got a couple more callers lined up. Hannah, you are on the air with Ann.
Hi, Hannah.
No, maybe Hannah did not stick around. All right. Let's go to... Well, I guess people are dropping off now. Let's see. Donald. Donald in Kentucky. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you tonight?
Hi there, Donald. Thank you for hanging on.
Oh, it's not a problem. Thank you for having the show.
What can I do for you? Absolutely.
Well, I have a situation. I live in Kentucky. My child and ex-wife live in Niagara Falls, New York. I have a divorce decree that plainly says both parties shall have unhindered phone access with the child when she is with the other parent. Wife shall put child on the phone for any call. Since October of 2009, I have logged about 100 missed phone calls. I have called the police department in Niagara Falls for surety checks, which I was advised by the police department to do. So that should be on some sort of record. I'm not able to access that record without a lawyer, of course. My daughter has a cell phone that was purchased by my ex-wife's now husband. She carries with her all the time. Her favorite activity is texting, talking on the cell phone, of course. I am blocked. My mother is blocked. My sister is blocked. Everyone in my family is blocked from contacting my daughter, including myself. And I still haven't talked to my daughter now in 2 months. I haven't seen her since January of this year. I was wondering, is it worth filing contempt charges with the courts to address the behavior with the mother? Because I can't talk to the mother. Every time I try to talk to the mother, I end up having to talk to the husband. And that's the only way that I've gotten information over the last 9 months about my daughter. Other than that, I don't even know what she's doing. So any suggestions?
Well, yes. Okay, so you're in Kentucky and they're in Niagara Falls, right?
Correct.
All right, and is the order from New York or Kentucky?
It is from New York.
All right. Then, what I would recommend that you do is you need a lawyer. You need to get yourself a lawyer in New York, and you need to have them file for a modification of your contact order. And that modification is based on the fact that they are not adhering to that that current order. And the thing that I would recommend to you is that you pull together records. You said you have this log of all these calls you've made and these times that you've had to call the police just to make sure your kids are okay. And, put that all together and put it in a spreadsheet and give that information to this lawyer that you're going to retain in New York so that they can go to the court and say, look, this isn't just something he's making up. Here is every time he tried to call during the times he was supposed to have contact. Here is, the number of the young lady, that's her cell phone number, and here's, the fact that he can't call, and give them all of that information, and you should be able to get some relief, but you have to do it the right way. You have to have a lawyer in New York, and you have to have them file there in the Niagara Falls court.
Okay.
Okay? Good luck to you. Thank you for calling, and thank you for holding on so long on hold.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, Brian, that has been a full show, and I am just very heartened that so many people took time out of their Labor Day evening to talk with us. Brian?
Yeah, next. Sorry, we've got so many callers. I'm having to jump through hoops to try to find people. But it's a madhouse. Apparently, you know what you're talking about, Ann. So that's very good.
Yes, see?
BJ from Virginia. But let everybody know that we're going to start wrapping it up. So fortunately, we can't take any more callers. We have a few more in the queue. We'll get to. But if you don't get a call in, you can send an email to info@nowyouknowradio.com, and you can ask Ann your legal questions that way, and she'll get back to you. BJ in Virginia, you're on the air with Ann.
Hi, Ann. I appreciate your show. This has been very interesting to listen to tonight. I appreciate you offering this. I just wanted to say you've mentioned consistently that men don't get a very fair shake in court, and And I was a firm believer of that as well. I had a girlfriend and we had a child in 97. And she was pretty much cutting off access, refusing to let me see my son. And, probably 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, $1,000 later, I do have him almost half the time. And it's only because I've had to drag her into court, and I guess I got a pretty good judge. But that was it, just a comment.
Oh, well, let me just say, first of all, good on you, that you're very fortunate that you were able to persist and that you had a good lawyer and a good judge. And I'm really, really pleased for you that it's worked out that way. And hopefully, whatever has happened in the past, you will be able to, if you haven't already, to forge some sort of a working civil relationship with your child's mother. Because one of the most important things that people need to remember is that if you have a child with someone, you will have to interact with them on some level until that child is at least 18, so you might as well make it as pleasant as possible. But good on you. And let me tell you also that your child, absolutely, as they grow up and they achieve adulthood and look back, they'll see that you really worked to make sure that you were able to stay actively involved in their lives. And let me take this opportunity to say to everybody listening that even in the case where your ex is telling your child lies about who you are or what you did or whether you love them or don't love them, and even in a situation where it just seems so bleak, as long as you stay the course and as long as you always do the right thing and as long as you don't give up and you always try to be involved with your child's life, kids have a really funny way of growing up and moving away. And when they're out of that house where they're hearing those lies, they will eventually see the truth. And more often than not, it's all going to backfire on that parent that was the one that was keeping the child from having a good relationship with both parents. And at some point, your child will know that you were trying hard to be involved with them. Anyway, BJ, thank you so much for the call.
And thank you to everybody for the fantastic calls tonight. It's really been an interesting evening. And it's come up a couple of times and people just don't know what to do. But let's say somebody is right at the beginning of this process. What's your quick, top three things that they need to do to find themselves a good divorce attorney?
Wow. The top
or is that a quick question?
It's a quick question. The question is it a quick answer?
All right.
Here's the thing. The best way to find a good lawyer, first of all, is I'll tell you what a good lawyer isn't. A good lawyer is not a lawyer who tells you everything you want to hear when you interview them. And there are lawyers who will do that. They will do that either because they don't know any better, because they're not that familiar with working with fathers, or they will do that because they want your retainer, and they figure once you're working with them, they'll tell you how it really is. There are any number of reasons that a lawyer might do that, but a lawyer who will tell you everything you want to hear instead of the reality, you don't want that. You want to know the truth. No matter how unpalatable it may be, you need to know the reality, because only when you know the reality can you actually start to deal with it. So now this may sound very self-serving, but my recommendation would be before you even retain a lawyer, get my book. And, truthfully, I don't make a whole lot from that book, so it's not like I'm trying to line my pockets. But the information in there is distilled from my years of practice working only with fathers. And personally, I like to think that it's got some good information in it. And that book is available right on Amazon. And you can just go to Amazon and search for Surviving Divorce and my name, Ann Mitchell, and it should pull it right up. It's a quick read. It's only $15. And that will give you a very good sense of what you're facing in whatever situation you have. So the reason I'm recommending that is because that is how you will know when you interview a lawyer whether they're telling you what they want to hear or what you want to hear or whether they're actually telling it to you. Right. So I would recommend getting that book. You know, if you don't want to, that's totally fine. It's just, you know, it's an option to help you really prepare yourself. Find a lawyer, interview a few lawyers, and go with the one that, A, you feel really is telling it like it is, not what you want to hear, and, B, that you have a good connection with. And let me tell you why this is so important. It's important that you feel confident in that lawyer because you are going to have to trust them implicitly with something even more important than your life. You are going to have to trust them with your children's lives. So you have to really feel like they are telling you the truth and they know what they're talking about, because you're going to have to take directions from them and you're going to have to be able to feel confident that you can do what they say. Now, how do you find those lawyers to interview? The very best way is start asking everyone you know. Hey, if you know someone who's been through a divorce, say, hey, who did you use? Who did your ex use? You know, were you happy with them? What did you think the job that your ex's lawyer did for them? Would you recommend them? What? You haven't been through a divorce? Wow, that's great. Do you know anyone who has? Maybe they can recommend the lawyer. This is what you might say to someone. You know, maybe if that person hasn't been through a divorce, they know someone who has, and they can find out what lawyer they use. The best way to find a good lawyer is through word of mouth. The worst way to find a lawyer is picking up the Yellow Pages. That's pretty much the worst way to find a lawyer is through advertising. So definitely ask around, ask people, and be prepared ahead of time so that you have some idea of what to expect.
Okay, Anne. Well, thank you very much for being our expert this week and taking on that hat. Next week we've got a great show with Dr. Robert Fludman. Is that correct, the orthodontist?
That is absolutely correct, and I also just want to say, remind people that they can leave us voicemail at the 877-NYK radio number, and please, please go to our NowYouKnowRadio.com website and like us on our Facebook page through the website so you can find out about all the upcoming shows at NowYouKnowRadio.com, and while you're there, click like on our Facebook page, please.
All right, see you next weekend.
See you, Brian. Happy Labor Day.